Hello, this is William Scott. Welcome back to the Folkways podcast. This is part three of an interview I did with Tan Staffel on Grimm's fairy tales, in particular the fairy tale Snow White and Rose Red. This is the final installment. For those who are hardcore about listening to Tan Staffel and William Scott chatting about fairy tales.
Yeah, have you looked at any of my? I have three pieces on my Folkways blog about these kinds of issues. Anyway, I don't
know. Which one are you referring to?
One of them was called "Reinstating Us and Them," or what is it called? Where are we here?
Yeah, "Reinstating Us and Them." We didn't need to listen to the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, did you read that?
I haven't read any of these. I didn't see that you had been fleshing out your website.
I'm going to actually pull on the weekend. I think I'm going to erase all the. I sort of built the thing and somehow had this fantasy that it would immediately fill with content. So what I think I've done is just created a frustrating situation where people come and find there's nothing there, or they don't know where to go where the stuff is. Although I do have a high rate of visitor to views, but I think they've just found their way to the blog. Yeah, so "Reinstating Us and Them," "The Hubris of Generosity." We were talking about hubris before. And then the others are, yeah, those are the two, really. I don't know about my polemic moralistic rant. I can't remember what that's about.
Well, I remember you contacted me when you first created your blog, and I like your vision. I mean, you're just a European guy wanting to express yourself as a European, perfectly healthy, perfectly natural. You do it in a typically white fashion, even. And so, more power to you. I hope that it's successful. I hope. But you know, my own take on it is: I think we also have to confront the fact against us. It's not just that we've sort of forgotten who we are and, lost. We didn't just drop our identity. It was beaten out of us. It's been psychopathologized. You know, it's been associated with everything and everything, anything and everything negative, every dirty trick possible, including, you know, telling us that this is a, you know, a fraud, basically, where, you know, here's poison, and by the way, it's a fruit drink. It's good for you. Drink this. That's how it's been done to us. Because if it was straightforward.
I guess for me, I see a lot of that happening around, and I'm engaging in that stuff as in my own internal conversation, and I do. And tonight we're doing this. This will not be like my sole focus. But it's certainly not something that can be avoided in the conversation. But I mean, I'm an artist, and I've felt my whole life I don't have a place. I don't have a platform, a space to put my art. And initially, my initial motivation was, and I haven't posted any of these essays. I've got tons and tons of essays I've started over the years. Over the last probably 4 years, I've really been doing a lot of writing, but haven't brought it out, and I only have so much time, and then I'm busy doing other things. I guess I'm an artist really more than anything, so I'm always making something, whether it be music or some kind of visual art or something. But I'm really wanting to create a space in which we posit where art can be posited for myself, but more so for just in general, because the context of art has been so corrupted. Like the space in which we, it's not just the art itself, which some of it is obviously very degenerate. But, yeah, I mean, I wish what's his name was still around.
Who's that?
Bowden, Jonathan Bowden. I thought he was, I've got a thing on here with him too. I don't know if you saw that. Where he does this thing on Punch and Judy, which also kind of inspired me about the, where is that? That's the problem with this whole thing. It's just freaking way too, it's too much like a library. You know, you almost need like a, a way of getting through it. So it's got to be changed. It's not really functioning. I think it's prohibitive. I think people are coming to it and being confused and not being able to go in because it's frustrating to scroll down, try to keep your cursor over these damn drop down menus anyway, let alone click on it and find that it's empty.
Bowden, it was a strange character. He was a very inspired speaker, and his encyclopedic knowledge of whatever topic he happened to be speaking was just awesome, amazing to hear. And I'm glad that there are at least recordings of him giving speeches. But I actually met him personally, spoke with him briefly, and he was basically an autist in person. And
oh, really?
And it's probably maybe because I am just so much, my intellect is maybe just so much like a slug in comparison to his, that that was the impression I got, that I was speaking Chinese or something to him. Because when I asked him, it was some in reference to liberalism, the difference between liberalism in Europe versus North America. And he just looked at me like I had three eyes, and not in a good way, you know, that my question was just so elementary or so stupid. And I was just making talk, you know. It wasn't it was at one of these small private conferences where I got the opportunity to talk with him. But he wore these glasses that were so thick he was he could hardly see. They were like Coke bottle type glasses.
Very strange guy.
Yeah, but for sure, he was, the autism helped when it came to giving speeches, because he would sit up there and just speak, and off the top of his head would just say these things, and just the complete sentences would just roll right out one after another without reading from any paper. And anytime someone speaks like that, you have to wonder how much did they rehearse beforehand or think about it beforehand. It's always seemed, I guess he just did it so much that he was very well practiced at it. But he was definitely very knowledgeable.
Had that script running through his head all the time, I bet.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, conversations, you can have conversations with people without meeting them in person. There is an aspect of it to meeting people in person. I've met other people, too, that I'm glad that I met them. But I've also made connections to people that I've never met face-to-face, just people that I've only read the printed words of, comments on my blog or comments on other blogs, where you get a feel for their mind and how they think and behave. And I appreciate that. I think one of the powerful things about the internet that has opened up the possibilities for us is this ability to communicate with each other, if only to be comforted by the realization that there are other people out there that are thinking the way we are thinking, that see things the way we see things, that we're not crazy, that we're not oddballs who have, you know, come up with some stupid, uniquely stupid way of seeing the world.
I think it's very, I think it's very encouraging. I think it's a lot of just, like I've said before, very reasonable people. I did find him there. He's under arts, art criticism. And there's a poem there I wrote for his passing, a sonnet. I went to all the trouble of composing a sonnet. So
under arts, I see. Well, these days, you know, most traffic comes to smaller websites by people finding you in a search. You know, they'll do a search for a topic and they'll see a hit to a link directly into your site. So no matter where you put it on your site, no matter how disorganized you are, you'll still get people coming in. But it does help to make it, you know, to invest the energy into making your site more navigable, more clearly organized, so people can find something they might be interested in.
Yeah, I'm just going to pare it right down and maybe have a page that, I kind of went nuts with it. That tends to be the way that I do, though. I tend to obsess and lose myself in what I'm doing and say, wow, I'm making this wonderful archive. And well, you know what, William, there's nothing in this archive. It's like I'm building a library when there are no books to put in it. There's no
You've made a bunch of folders with labels on them, but there's no papers in them yet.
I thought maybe it would inspire me to just, like, you know, create. And I was also kind of hoping others might join in, but I think that it's so, you know, it takes a while, the whole trust thing, and as well as market too. I mean, it probably needs to be, you know, people who want to give their stuff away for free, but I was more just really hoping people would put links in it, you know, links to sites and stuff like that. So anyway, I'm actually going to do two things. I'm going to, if you don't mind me just indulging in this real quick, I'm going to simplify, get rid of a lot of the crap here that doesn't have anything. I'm also going to make a video, introductory video, because it seems to be the way it is. People want to hear reading is something we do when we're decided we're sitting down and committing. We kind of scrap read all over the internet all the time, but actual reading is not something that we do quite as often as we should, or as I certainly don't read as much as I should.
Yeah, I used to read
all the time. I read words all day long, but I don't, you know, I don't sit down and read careful contemplative kind of reading.
Right, it's got to be relatively short nowadays. I have shelves full of books that I read as a young man. I can't believe how much I read, but lately I read almost nothing that's printed in the form of a book. I'll read books that are PDFs occasionally on the internet, but the bulk of the reading that I do even there is just these short snippets, short abstracts of things, and maybe an occasional 1-2-page column. And I don't really write very much anymore either. I made the transition mostly to podcasting, and I did try to do both, basically do a transcript or write it out ahead of time. But that's an incredible burden too. It requires an awful lot of polish and preparation to do it that way. This, you know, to be able to sit down and talk with you for 2.5 hours is relatively easy. I mean, it took just a short time of thinking, reading the background material, the listening to your previous discussion was probably the bulk of it, and that was a pleasure. So I hope people who listen to this, the handful of people that do, get the same sort of pleasure of just unapologetically white people talk about white things. And that's that was part of what I thought the value of the work at the White Network and my collaboration with my partner there, Carolyn Yeager, was about. And when we would sit down and have conversations with each other and occasionally with one or two other people, that was always good fun. And I enjoy having these kind of conversations with people, even if it's the first time I'm talking to them. It's fun to get somebody else's view on it. Your thing about scripts, for instance. I didn't mean to go on for so long, but to hear your take on that was interesting.
I was just trying to not use the word narrative again, I guess. But it's a little different. A script, I was kind of almost using it as a programming term as well. You know, something kind of driving, running, pushing, and I've run on parallel scripts a lot of my life. I kind of feel like, I feel as if I am summarizing into some kind of whole, a much more whole. I feel more whole than I ever expected I would in my life. I kind of always thought I would be frazzled and splayed, you know, like cardboard in a puddle. You know, it's. In some ways, I'm very happy with where things are. To actually become awake is a real blessing.
Yeah, it wasn't to me. It wasn't a transformative thing, as in like I had to overhaul my whole knowledge base. For me, and I've made this point before, that it was mainly about change in point of view. It was an understanding that the facts were all still pretty much the same, although there were some facts now that I realized were just nonsense. Lies, that was part of it, but it was really just a shift in attitude and point of view. So instead of thinking of myself in a, you know, I can't think about race, can't think about things in that way, now I do think about it that way, and it makes much more sense that way. And that's where the happiness comes from, I think, is we feel much better when we actually understand what's going on around us. When things are going on around us and we don't really have the not a script, but the mental model is what programmers call it, which is an understanding of why things are happening around us. And this is sort of the basics of physics. The science of physics is about creating mental models of understanding the reality around us. Why, when I drop a ball, the rate it falls at, you know, and the force it hits with, that is not just physics that can kind of understanding can be applied to, but also your worldview generally of how you think about yourself and your place in the world. What is good? What is bad? What's right to do? What's not right to do? And that can flip like a switch.
Yeah, that's exactly. Like I found that, I just feel the flow better. You know, there's less conflicts in a way, even though I'm seeing myself in a world of deep in conflict in my own self. I have a strength and a kind of just summing up into a whole person, which is good. I mean, maybe that happens in age anyway. I don't know, but not always. Some people just drink themselves into oblivion. I probably should round up. One more thing. Oh yeah. We should sometime chat about being from Cali. A couple of crackers from Cali. Where did you grow up in California?
I didn't grow up in California. I grew up in the New York City area.
Oh.
And I think I discussed this in my first podcast. I went to school in upstate New York, ended up meeting my wife there, and then got married upon graduation and moved to California, where my parents had since relocated. While I was in university, they had decided that they couldn't take New York anymore and moved to Southern California.
And so you're
an East Coast. It's funny, in where I live now, in where I live in the mountains of North Carolina, Appalachia, they call people like me halfbacks. Although usually what they do, halfbacks move from New York or the Northeast down to the Southeast, down Florida, because they're like snowbirds. They want to get away from the cold weather. But then they find out that Florida is not America anymore, and it's full of Caribbeans and overrun, really. And then they move halfway back to either South Carolina or North Carolina or Virginia, because it is still in Appalachia. And this is part of how I selected this place to move when I decided that I couldn't stay in California, because honestly, California, the same thing is happening there that's happening in Florida. And I saw on a census map, probably the 2000 or 2000, I guess it was the 2000 census, where they had the ethnicity of, or the country, I think it was the country of origin, that the majority of the people in that area thought of themselves as, and it was a county breakdown, not a state breakdown, so it was fairly fine-grained. And all of Appalachia showed American as the dominant ethnicity. In other words, the people, the white people there, thought of themselves not as Brits or Scots or Huguenot or whatever. They thought of themselves as Americans. It was still America there, and that's still what I how I explain it to people, at least to start with, is why I'm here and what made me decide to come here was it's still America here. The white people here are not the kind of white people that you run into in places like New York City or the other major urban areas, where they might be dominant, you know, white faces might dominate, but they're, you know, who knows what kind of people from who knows where. Whereas in the mountains
they're Celts basically, aren't they?
Well, in the mountains, it's actually, I think mainly it's Anglo-Saxon stock, but there is a sort of mythology that's grown up that everybody is Scots-Irish. They're Scots who moved to Ireland and then moved further on to Appalachia. And there is definitely an element to it, but most of the people have been here so long. I mean, they literally moved into this area and are the descendants of the people, the whites who moved into this area in the wake of the American Revolution and settled the whole string of mountains from Pennsylvania all the way down into the Ozarks. And I'm sort of in the middle of it, north to south-wise. And it's wonderful country, but the tragedy is that the people here, I expected before I came not knowing anybody here, I expected to find the Klan still burning crosses and, you know, people racially aware that they don't want niggers up here in the mountains. And there is an element of that. But for the most part, it's just white people being white people. They're not particularly organized or conscious of what they have and the value of it. They are standoffish people who are perfectly happy with the little that they have. And they are distrustful of tourists and foreigners, which is what they call people like me. And I perfectly understand it. And I tell them whatever opportunity I have that the reason why this place is so nice is because you're like that. So don't, you know, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but, you know, don't ever let that go, because that's what keeps you you. And don't ever be guilt tripped out of it. They're fantastic people. These Appalachian people are, they're simple people, but they're also intelligent and good people, good-hearted people. And once you do get to know them, they are like the bear in the fairy tale. They are just big teddy bears, really. Good people.
And, good. So are you, Town Staffel.
Thank you, William. I appreciate it. I could tell from hearing you, speaking to Ayla and from our conversations that, you know, there's a connection between us. You know, we think similarly, we're from similar backgrounds, and that really is what ethnocentricity springs from the genetic similarity, but also this cultural similarity that we have, or similar sensibilities, what makes sense to us, the arguments that we make to each other, our likes and dislikes.
Yeah. I don't even try to pretend. I've kind of never really have that my likes, dislikes, disposition should be that I should assume that somebody of another race should share those.
Hmm. I mean, me neither.
There's two ways in which that's done. One is in this apparent generosity, but in that generosity also comes an imposition. So, yeah, it's a strange.
And
these people just don't think enough.
I think most of us are like that, though. It's really, there's a twisted minority that actually embrace this destructive attitude toward our race, that our race is inherently bad and evil and needs to be dismantled and destroyed, and becomes Antifa, becomes antagonistic. I think the bulk of the people are, their failing is simply in not thinking very deeply or consciously about the larger group that they belong to, that they were born into. And there's good reason for it, because they hear on that damn television every time they tune into it that's bad, that you shouldn't think those things. And so they think they're being good people and this is the first thing you hear out of any Republican's mouth when somebody accuses them of being racist. They, oh no, I'm not a racist. And they really believe that. They don't want to be racist, and they don't, you know, they don't want to think in those terms. And that's, we have to get past that. And beyond what you or I could do, it's the reality, the facts on the ground that are inevitably coming out of that television, even with the spin attached to it. People are more and more, it's so blatant that they can see it with their own eyes, that this is sick, this is wrong.
And
the narrative that blames white people ultimately for everything that's going wrong in the world, you know, white people that are watching on the television at home or looking on their web browser and in the internet, they realize there's a fundamental dishonesty in that it's not, you know, there may be white faces in charge of universities, for instance, but those people don't think of themselves as white. They don't administer the universities as proud white people. They are
to the benefit of
hollow shells who are trying as best as they can to serve the interests of non-whites. And that's becoming more and more clear to people. So this nonsense about white privilege and structural racism and all, just racism in general, I think people are beginning to realize, white people, that this is just a racial slur. It means when somebody says racist, it's they're calling you a name. They're calling you a nasty name from their point of view. And we have to understand that it's not nasty to be white. It's just who we are. It's and that when somebody attacks us in that fashion, that what all they're doing really is declaring themselves to be our enemies, and that we ought to treat them accordingly.
Yeah. It's not a, there's, it's a long, I don't even know what it is. I don't know if it's a long haul or what it is. I'm quite taken by surprise most days at what's going on. We could just be early, the early signs, and then there could be a wave of people flipping over. I mean, part of what I want to do too, in not necessarily related to the site, but in other ways, is just put out a lot of encourage and or participate in putting out a lot of different ways to articulate white awareness that would hit different people. I mean, I honestly think that the white Christian male, the conservative, the ones that lost their, there's a whole story can be told about that. Partly it's their own fault in some ways, but by being too insular, too narrow, too fundamentalist. But those people now, those churches that have been, they've lost a lot. I mean, I remember growing up in the 80s. I mean, the world has changed so much since then in terms of our, what we could say, what freedoms we had, right? These things have changed. And these people have, I think they actually had, there's a good group of people there who are in the habit of talking about virtue. You know, I mean, virtuous discussion is something that takes place in Christian churches. It's not something we hear a lot on television or in other places, but in those contexts, they still do believe in worthiness and in goodness. And I think there's a lot of potential there. The problem is they're running on this anti-racist thing as being a sin, right? That racism is sin. But I don't know, somehow articulating, because those are the people who would have the ability to turn, by sheer numbers, have the ability to turn this thing around, at least in the States. Maybe the States will be where that revival takes place. I don't know.
I have a fairly dim view of Christianity, and I'll just say that, yes, it has taken a real turn for the worse in recent decades with the, I guess, Vatican II, with the Catholic faith, and the other sects have their own kind of watershed turning points, but in adopting this really poisonous agenda of degeneracy, promoting homosexuality and so forth, the problem is much deeper, though, with Christianity, and the basic problem is this, which is conversion. This idea that, and this has been a problem from the very beginning of the church, that to be a Christian, to become part of us, all you have to do is espouse the beliefs that we do, accept these beliefs, and that's where the problem begins. Is when you people, Jews historically have done this, say they accept the beliefs to become part of us, but they don't really accept the beliefs, and they maintain their own identity within. And this is the problem of crypsis of Jews. And it's not just Christianity that's vulnerable in this way. Even nationalism that isn't strictly blood and soil type of nationalism is vulnerable in this way as well. Any identity that doesn't have a biological requirement or a very, very strict ideological requirement that is like tested constantly for veracity is vulnerable to infiltration by Jews and other enemies, ultimately, or infiltrators, aliens. At least my point of view is not that it's mostly a spiritual cohesiveness that we need, or that is the reality that drives things. It's a biological reality that actually drives things, and culture and beliefs and all of that stuff springs from the biology, which is the more important aspect of it. you need both. You need for common people to survive as a people. Those people need to be of shared heritage, and they need to have a common sense of who they are and the direction that they want to go. If they divide ideologically, even a common gene pool will speciate and become two separate peoples over a length of time, and maybe one will extinguish the other through warfare. That's even more likely. But what I'm saying is that if you just have ideological, it can happen, I suppose. That's the idea behind ethnogenesis, is that a group of people put in a pressure cooker for long enough, like a diamond, like coal under pressure, will form a diamond. You know, people with a common, eventually all the genes will sort of smear out a group around that group, and they'll adopt common customs and way of thinking. And I think the reality is more like Europeans are a good example of this. The strata of the genetic differences don't go away even after thousands of years of mixing. And there is still in Europeans an observable, the difference of Europeans turns out to be a different mixture of different components of different peoples that came together and mixed. And, you know, the three main components being the Ice Age hunter-gatherers in Europe that were then impinged upon and combined with these Near Eastern farmers, and then ultimately the Aryans came in various waves. And the different mixes of those three basic components is what gives us the differences in Europeans today, along with some other historical things and other groups like Hungarians who came in afterwards. But you know, my point is that the biology is really the driving and determining factor, and that takes long periods of time. It's certainly much longer than a human lifetime. It can be undone in a single human lifetime, but it takes many, many generations to smooth out over and become mm-hmm, cohesive mm-hmm. over time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. To become. A separate.
And religion can help it. You know, the way Jews use religion is as a sort of bionic extension to the biological peoplehood. The religious strictures that they operate under can be seen as a sort of cryptic manual for how to keep your people together racially as a biological entity. The rules about circumcision, which is indirectly discourages conversion from the outsiders wanting to come in because they don't want to go through that pain. All of those strictures on food and so forth are just seen as rituals that are going to turn off outsiders and also set apart Jews themselves. So that's how I understand their religiousness. And the Christianity ultimately or originally came from Jews, and I don't think that the initial plan was, let's create a belief system that will totally screw up the Goyim, although there may be some elements to that. And certainly along the way, it seems to have been guided that way. And there's a great deal of Christianity is Europeanness expressing itself too, unfolding within
that's my thing with that. I mean, bring it back to the folk tales here. That the good thing about the folk tales with this whole argument in our community between traditional folk religion, paganism sometimes called atheism, and Christianity is these folk tales cut through at least through the folk tradition and the Christianity, because they endure. They're in fact the only record of, in some cases, like I was saying before, in the Ukraine, that probably is any kind of through line, pre-Christian through line for traditional reflection, right? So it's I that's why I like them so much as well. It's another reason why I find them appealing, is that they're kind of, and yet they aren't neutral ground. I mean, for me, there's nothing neutral. It actually brings us, it's a tunnel back to pre-Christianity in a way. I mean, I still go to church. I still go to mass because there's nothing yet that replaces that for me. And I find it important. And it's also, there's so much. I mean, I go to a high Anglican church. I mean, it's sort of like one of the reasons it appealed to me when I first started going, because it felt so damn white, you know? So, there, it is true.
That's God the reason made, that the Jews white. Do it too, is, and they do it even more explicitly, I think, in that it will keep their kids around other Jews, and that will become who their love interests are and ultimately who they marry and reproduce with. And that's a good, basically cryptical way of white people maintaining their whiteness, and is to socialize via churches. But it's not a guarantee, and it won't just operate on its own. It has to be conscious. It has to be somewhat acknowledged.
At this point, it does. In the past, it didn't, because people weren't traveling across borders like they are now. When they weren't, and that's the whole thing. Like, it was a default, and that's one of the problems with Christianity. It's in the place of an ethnic religiosity tradition. It's in the stead of that. But it's universal, so therefore it can't.
Yes.
When the ethnic reality is challenged, it's not ready to respond.
Well,
it's actually ready to help. It's there to help in deterioration, and that's the problem.
Exactly.
Whereas for years and as I say, centuries, it functioned as a means of preserving, because it was in the place of the earlier traditions. But there wasn't the great mobility of people. But now in this current time, it just stands there with the door open. You know, it's the door opener rather than the containment.
Well, again, my point is that it goes, that this element of trap door or back door into European society has been there from the beginning. This idea that anytime a Jew wanted to an in into our society, they could just go to the nearest church, get some holy water sprinkled on them, profess the faith, show up at church once a week, and they were considered Christians and accepted. The reality, of course, is that it wasn't to convert, and they really are just accepted wholeheartedly. In the past, there was an awareness of racial inheritance was important, and that even Jews who had converted, for instance, in Spain, they called them new Christians, because there was a widespread, well-understood tendency for it to be a dishonest conversion, and it was recognized as such. But the hope was always held out that they, and that persisted today, that they would convert if some of them would be sincere. Even the majority maybe would be sincere in their conversion. And that really is the seeds. That's enough of a seed of destruction of Europeans right there, because it's a trapdoor. It's a backdoor for infiltration, for invasion. Today we see the invaders are called refugees, and that's the big backdoor that they're given. Our navies actually go out into the water to fetch them, to bring them safely to the shores. And that is an enormous backdoor, a physical backdoor, and to even compare the two might seem absurd. But what I'm saying is that qualitatively, they are the same thing. This belief system that goes back 2,000 years, that we have a church and that's what defines our community, but anybody who wants to show up at the church and say that they profess our faith, they'll be welcome. And that included Jews. And then once they became part of the church, then they rose up in the management of the church and the decisions about, you know, how other things would, what the policies would be for the church. And over the course of time, that, you know, they eventually hollowed it out. And we're at the point where we are now, where, you know, the church is basically like an extension of the rest of the institutions that the cultural Marxists have marched through and hijacked and now used for their own purposes.
Yeah, I get that. It's a very ultimately it's a very liberal institution. I was actually slated to become a priest at one point. I was working my way towards that, but
Well, I'm not exaggerating, am I? This conversion backdoor was there from the beginning. That's
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. No, it was really kind of a time bomb in a way, or a time door or something. Yeah. But I really must go at this point.
Well, all right, William. Thank you very much for spending as much time as you did with me. It's been a very pleasurable experience.
For me too. I was just thinking same thing I said to Ayla. It's like I'm hearing your voice, and it sounds just like your voice I've heard for 3, 4, 5 years, or whatever it's been. So it's just sort of like, it's just when you first came on, I'm listening to Tess now. I must be listening to Age of Treason, because Tess novel's speaking. And then you actually wouldn't respond to me because you couldn't hear me. So it was just like it.
Well, I'm glad I took the time in retrospect to write down so many of my thoughts or to speak them and put that effort into it, because now anybody who's curious, who thinks that anything that we've said tonight is their interest is piqued by it, there's a whole body of recordings and writings that they can go and they can find out more about this kind of stuff.
It is a worthy archive. You've created a worthy archive. It was a very, very important to me. Now that you're not putting them out regularly, I miss them. I wish, I hope you. Maybe you should, keep yourself to 2 a year or something.
Well, there's more in me. I have, I'm constantly thinking of this idea or that idea. What I couldn't do anymore was just the grind of doing it every week and, kind of repeating myself. I don't. This conversation was very good because it was something not completely different than what I've talked about before, but a really different premise behind the whole thing.
Oh, that's my daughter. She's hungry.
I'll let you go, William. All right, so just send me an email when it's up and let me know.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I'm not sure whether you want the whole thing or because it's going to, at this point,
Hey, trim it down. Trim out whatever you want. Go to whatever effort or non-effort you want. I'd encourage you to actually try and shorten it a bit, abbreviate it if you can.
Well, 2 hours and 23 minutes at this point, so.
Yeah, so it's unpalatable for people to listen to that much.
So, no, but what I'd probably do is issue it as a series of podcasts and try to
That's a good idea.
Maybe keep it, because we did kind of talk in sections to some degree. Anyway, yeah.
However you want to do it. Yeah, I appreciate
it. This is William Scott, and I've been interviewing. I'll do something or other to finish it. I'm just too tired now, too hungry to pretend I'm doing a live radio podcast. Anyway.
All right. Hey, good talking to you, William. I'll talk to you again in the future.
Yes, we will indeed. We'll have another chat on another fairy tale, perhaps.
Good luck to you this year on whatever you're going to be working on.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
All right. Good night.
Okay, Beth. Good night.